Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Currently being held in the Metropolitan Detention Center in New York City, Nicolas Maduro, president of Venezuela, is awaiting trial. Facing charges like narco-conspiracy, the former leader may spend the rest of his time in a prison cell, while his country tries to build back. What do Venezuelans think of their president being removed? And what do Americans think of the seizure of the president of Venezuela? And how will this action impact citizens of both countries? Joining us now is Sabrina Siddiqui, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome to All Sides, Sabrina.
Thanks for having me.
So the events of January 3rd were a long time coming because there were tensions between Venezuela and the Trump administration. They had been building. But as someone who covers this, were you surprised by the raid that day and the physical removal of Maduro?
I think the answer is yes and no, because there's been a lot of attention in recent months on the strikes that the Trump administration had been carrying out in the region against these alleged drug boats. And the big question that a lot of people had, including lawmakers here in Washington, was what is this really all about? And the administration, you know, had been saying for some time that the U.S. is engaged in an armed conflict with drug cartels. But a lot of people really felt like all of that action was a buildup toward something bigger in Venezuela. And very much, you know, the thinking was that they are looking at potential regime change. And Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro is someone who not just the Trump administration has set its sights on for some time, but actually Secretary of State Marco Rubio specifically has long criticized and long wanted to see removed from power. So I think, you know, maybe the way in which it went down was a bit of a surprise, but in some ways, the writing had been on the wall for some time now.
And who exactly is charging Maduro? I know the case is in New York. Are these considered federal charges or international charges? Can you explain this to me, the charges?
Yeah. It is a U.S. federal indictment in the Southern District of New York. And he's been charged on four counts, primarily on narco-terrorism and drug trafficking charges. There's going to be some debate, I think, around, the administration's approach to all of this. But I think that, you know, one of the bigger things I think that has come up, of course, is again, motivations here, because what's come up is that the president, I just wanted to pull it up so I'm accurate in terms of like how I'm characterizing it. Mm-hmm. Apologies for that.
That's okay.
But you know, the president, has actually obviously more infamously pardoned former Honduran president Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was also convicted on drug trafficking charges. So I think that, you know, there is this little bit, that's why I want to bring that up, because there's been this question around the charges facing Nicolas Maduro, which I don't think anyone is disputing in terms of their legitimacy, but more so President Trump's actual motivations when it comes to his policy in Venezuela, and just some of that contradiction that inherently exists in the Trump administration being the one that's really pushing for these charges against Maduro just after the president pardoned former Honduran president who had helped actually move at least 400 tons of cocaine into the U.S.
This idea of the charge being called narco conspiracy with a terrorist group, or however it's being said, narco terrorism, does that mean like drug related terrorism, or how, like, do you know how that works?
Yeah, that's essentially what the Trump administration is arguing. I mean, look, like this kind of comes back to something that the president had really campaigned against, which was, really trying to crack down on the illegal flow of deadly drugs coming across the border. And it kind of like it kind of has been very much where the administration has centered a lot of its argument when it comes to its justification for its actions in Venezuela. They had threatened military action primarily over these accusations that Maduro and his regime were supporting the drug trade and responsible for, the deaths of Americans here in the United States simply by, again, focusing on the flow of drugs into the country. So that's where they're kind of coming back to this idea of what they're referring to as narco-terrorism, because when you also bring in the word terrorism, there's been a lot of questions around the legality of all of it. And the president did not have a new war authorization for any of his military action in Venezuela. And so, when I think there's a lot of deference when it comes to counterterrorism actions, and that's why they've really been trying to focus, I think, more so on this idea of narco-terrorism as a legal underpinning also for the actions that they've taken in Venezuela.
Let's talk for a few minutes about how Venezuela is being currently governed, because there's what President Trump says, that we're offering assistance, we're running the country, different words are being said. But what have you found whenever it's how Venezuela is being governed right now today?
Well, what's been really interesting about it is that it's, we've talked to people in our reporting who say it's not so much regime change as it is regime management. Because on the one hand, they've removed Nicolas Maduro from power, but at the same time, the Trump administration has actually kept the rest of the dictatorship's hardliners in place, including other top officials who have been wanted by the US for drug trafficking and other crimes. And they've actually, as we've seen, kind of downplayed the importance or the significance of the Venezuelan opposition. So what that all kind of comes down to is this strategy where it looks like the administration is trying to actually force Venezuela's leaders into a policy direction that is more friendly to the United States rather than actually removing the government that's now been in power for almost 3 decades. Rather than removing that government entirely and risking all of the instability that comes with that. And I think that that's actually going to have somewhat of a mixed reaction when it comes to ordinary Venezuelans, where on the one hand, yes, it does avoid what could be a very bloody civil conflict, but then it also takes away their hopes of a quicker transition toward democracy and meaningful economic recovery.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the latest news related to Venezuela with Sabrina Siddiqui, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. There's been a lot of talk about the Venezuelan oil. And so some have said that, President Trump wanted to remove a dictator who wasn't willing to negotiate with him regarding the oil. So if he leaves part of the Maduro administration in there, is he hoping the government will stay stable and he'll be able to negotiate with them for the oil?
Yeah, and I think that's very much a big factor here. President Trump has really been urging executives from honestly, from nearly 2 dozen oil companies to invest in Venezuela and drill into one of the world's largest oil bounties. But, and I think there's some hope too, as you pointed out, that by kind of trying to play ball with the existing Venezuelan government having now removed Maduro and threatened all these consequences, that the US also may have more leverage to move Venezuela toward a framework, toward a commercial framework that is beneficial to the United States. What's been interesting is that most of the executives that the president has been appealing to have stopped short of making public pledges to quickly invest. And I think a lot of them are concerned about the volatility in the region. And, you know, what we've been hearing in our reporting is that, you know, executives, whether they're from Chevron or ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, some of the big names that they want are security guarantees and also an overhaul of the legal and commercial framework within Venezuela before they consider diving in and again putting themselves at risk in what is a very volatile and fast-moving situation.
I wanted to turn to Americans for a moment. In your reporting, you've talked to Americans about this entire thing. How have Americans reacted to the capture of Maduro? Does the average American, I don't know that you represent the average American, but you talk to some, do you feel, did they feel like it was a necessary move?
Well, it's a little bit interesting. You know, we're still starting to see, you know, numbers that, you know, have come in since the actual raid itself. And I think that, you know, there is support for capturing Maduro. Like, there's not a lot of sympathy for someone like Nicolas Maduro. But at the same time, this is not a priority for the American public. So I think what often happens is when you kind of take, and we've seen this in our own polling at the Wall Street Journal, you take an individual issue like Venezuela and you break it down for the American people. And you're going to often see that, hey, if you're asking people, do you support removing, you know, this dictatorship that, needless to say, is very unpopular, most Americans will say yes. And do you support, but then when you start asking about U.S. involvement in doing so, and also in the aftermath, that's where you start to see more hesitation. And so, you know, I'd say a majority of Americans, in the numbers at least that we've seen, do not want the U.S. to engage militarily in Venezuela. You know, this is a very war-weary public. We've seen time and again over the last, you know, decade especially, that there's been a reluctance to get involved in another conflict overseas. And so that's where the support begins to decline, depending on just how long the administration thinks the U.S. will be there or be involved. I mean, they're saying no boots on the ground. Certainly that would be something that would be extraordinarily unpopular. And then I think also, even if you kind of take the numbers and say, okay, look, most people support removing Maduro, maybe the raid will prove popular as a standalone act. It's so low on the list of priorities for the public. So foreign policy just has not been a big issue for the American public for a long time now, probably since the Iraq War, when it truly, truly had an impact on moving people at the ballot box. Now, I think what's been true is that the cost of living, the economy and jobs has just been such a driving force for the American electorate over the last few years. And that really is going to be the defining issue as of now in the midterms, barring anything catastrophic in Venezuela or in Iran, where the U.S. is also weighing possible military action.
What about Venezuelans, both those living in America and those in Venezuela? They, for the most part, from what we know, they wanted the dictator removed. Do they agree with that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's been interesting because I think there's been a lot of celebration among Venezuelans, both here in the U.S. and in the country itself, with respect to the removal of Maduro. I think that, you know, there is, of course, concern around the uncertainty that that this has brought in terms of what the future of the country looks like, both in the near and the long term. There is frustration, certainly, that we've heard from some, and you're starting to hear that certainly from the people of Venezuela around what we were talking about earlier with respect to still keeping a lot of the top officials from Maduro's regime in place. So it's not actually a real transition with respect to the government. And that means, again, those hopes of like a new democracy have kind of been dashed, at least for now. And then here at home in the United States, I think there's also just tension around the Trump administration's actions on immigration, because of course he did move, the Trump administration did move to deport Venezuelans without permanent residency. You know, many of them had been allowed to stay in the US after they were granted what's known as TPS, temporary protected status. And then President Trump revoked that designation after taking office. And so, you know, there's still a lot of fear that they may be sent back to the same government that they left behind, even if Maduro isn't still there. So I think it's a little bit of a mixed bag. A lot of people are celebrating the removal of Maduro again as a sort of a standalone act, but there are a lot of questions around what remains, both in Venezuela as well as with respect to the Trump administration's policy toward Venezuelans who are living here in the United States.
Before we run out of time, I wanted to ask you if the capture of Maduro will have a direct impact on American lives in the foreseeable future. Like the average American, does it matter to them that Maduro is not in power?
No, I don't think the average American, frankly, you know, I talked to a pollster. I just talked to a pollster when this was all happening. And one of the quotes that stood out was that this was a pollster who's, you know, one of President Biden's former pollsters, but he's also worked with Republican pollsters. So he's not just like a purely, you know, partisan. I mean, because it's the same thing. I talked to Republican pollsters who said the same thing, frankly. And they've been doing all these focus groups across the country in key battlegrounds, especially with midterms around the corner. And, you know, what this pollster said is, I don't know, frankly, don't know any American who woke up on that first Saturday in of the new year, or you know, woke up, you know, on the first day, frankly, in the new year, and said, "Huh, what I really just want is for someone to remove Nicolas Maduro from power." You know, like in terms of Americans, I'm not downplaying the significance, right? In Venezuela, sure, right? But I'm not downplaying the significance of it. But you know, here in the United States, this is not something that people have been thinking about. You know, I mean, there, I think again, you may support it in principle, but it's not something that has a tangible effect on the average American person. Now, what the Trump administration may do is they may argue that the oil piece, you know, what they're trying to do to unlock cheaper energy, and bring the costs of energy down in the US, that's something that they could possibly sell to the public that would benefit the average person if they are able to actually achieve that as an end goal. But we're still a ways away from there. And for now, I think this is mostly a legacy building issue for the Trump administration rather than something that really impacts the day-to-day politics here at home.
I want to thank you so much for your time. We've been talking with Sabrina Siddiqui, a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And coming up, what influence and power does the United States actually have in South America? And we will continue with that when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. The United States is no stranger to helping South American countries establish democracies in the wake of a dictator. Often citing the Monroe Doctrine, presidents have used it as evidence to exert influence and power over countries in the Western Hemisphere. What did Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro do that made the U.S. feel a need to step in? in such a dramatic way? And what does the future of the country look like without its leader? Joining us now is Christopher McKnight Nichols, Woody Hayes Chair in National Security Studies at The Ohio State University. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hi, Amy. It's great to be on.
Let's start with Nicolas Maduro. As someone who studies things like this for a living, when you woke up on January 3rd and you found out that the U.S. had physically removed Maduro from Venezuela, what was your immediate reaction?
First, I was surprised. Mm-hmm. Putting this sort of operation together obviously didn't happen overnight. And it is fairly unprecedented, if not downright unprecedented, to take a leader from Central or South America and to try them in the U.S. in this sort of really dramatic way. We had seen a lot of bluster, as you were just talking about in the earlier reporting. But it seemed unlikely that this would lead to a kinetic strike, as they say, right there in Caracas, in Venezuela, and grabbing and leaving with the president and his wife.
And does removing Nicolas Maduro, I mean, what's the impact on Venezuela? Because my understanding is it's not a lawless state right now because most of the other leadership was still there.
Right. It's, you know, it's sort of a continuing of the regime in a different, slightly different form. So the interim president, Delcy Rodriguez, is running it. She was the vice president. Almost the entire Maduro team is still operating. As far as we can tell, all the reporting out of Venezuela is that things are operating fairly similarly as to how they were before. But it's a statement. It is a significant move by the U.S. It comes with real questions in terms of international law and domestic policy, right? Should Congress have had a role? That sort of thing. So that's why it's so surprising. It's such a dramatic change with very little real warning. And I don't think anyone was really had this on their bingo card, so to speak, mm-hmm. although it's much more serious than that coming into the new year.
Maduro as the leader of Venezuela, I mean, you study this. Was he a dictator, as many claim?
Absolutely. He didn't win the 2024 election. Virtually every outside observer said as much. It may well have been a two-thirds election, even with sort of paramilitary forces there preventing people in July 2024 from coming out and voting. In exile is Maria Corina Machado, who's the well-known recipient in 2025 of the Nobel Peace Prize, which Donald Trump wanted himself, as the leader of the opposition. She couldn't even run in that election. She was out of the country. A guy by the name of Edmundo Gonzalez ran and arguably won and was recognized by the U.S. as the lawful leader of Venezuela, all of which is to say the U.S. was not never recognized Maduro in the second Trump administration as being the lawful leader, which is part of their legal justification. For this, he was a dictator. They're releasing some people from jail right now as a goodwill gesture. Leaders around the world, even ones who critiqued the U.S.'s actions here, recognize that Maduro was a bad leader. People in Venezuela are now close to 90% in poverty. It's a fairly rich country mm-hmm. overall. So the terrible leadership, and this extends back several, really a generation, to Hugo Chavez and antagonism between the U.S. And Venezuela, but also mismanagement of the oil reserves. Venezuela, as everybody probably knows who's been following this at all, sits mm-hmm. on the largest oil reserves in the world right now. So that mismanagement has come at a huge cost to the Venezuelan people.
Sabrina Siddiqui from The Wall Street Journal, who was on previously, she said that she talked to people who saw Maduro being ousted as a or being removed rather as being kind of like a management change. That's what she because everything is still there. A lot of people are still there, but the way it's being managed has shifted a bit. Would you agree with that?
Management and the figurehead. I think figureheads matter, right? Mm-hmm. The individual and sort of how we pack within them the values of a country really does matter. And having shifted that may make some significant changes moving forward. You know, I also think the symbolism of removing someone like Maduro is significant in a broader international realm. If you think about other kind of right-wing leaders and dictators around the world, what the Trump administration is aiming to signal, I think, is a level of power that suggests that the U.S. might do this in other places. And you've heard some saber rattling about Cuba, about Colombia, about perhaps Mexico, and other leaders and other places in the world should be taking note. So it's not just management, it's what the management change signifies. But the other piece of it is the you know, if you really wanted regime change, there's a pre-existing opposition in Venezuela that is well thought of in the international community and that has had a lot of support, so much support that they arguably won the 2024 election.
Do you think the Trump administration will try to help that party have an election and get into power, or has there been no indication of that?
Yeah, the latter. There's been no indication whatsoever. And in fact, Donald Trump has regularly said he doesn't think they're up to the job.
What do you think the United States plans are then for the country? Do you think there's a thought out plan, or are they kind of taking it day by day?
It's pretty clearly day by day. You know, I think one of the things that struck me immediately after this action was, OK, what have they set up? Right. So if you're at a policy level, you would want to have a strategy that said, OK, we've already lined up with specific oil companies how to invest and what that would look like. What have they set up in terms of so there had been sanctions against Venezuela for the U.S. There's currently an oil embargo. So the U.S. is interdicting tanker ships. We're hearing reports that Chinese tanker ships are turning around. So that suggests that there was not a plan, right? Mm-hmm. That if there had been a plan, it would have been to control port facilities. It would have been to figure out how the economics would work, and also what the U.S.'s leverage was, so that the U.S. doesn't have to, say, run the country, as Donald Trump has regularly said, even suggesting that he is, you know, sharing a meme of him being the interim acting president. Mm-hmm. The joking aside, there doesn't seem to be that sort of strategy. So now it's ad hoc and trying to figure out. As we saw last week, oil executives were brought to the White House. They expressed the sort of things you'd imagine at the White House, but what they ultimately said was, we need security guarantees and we need federal government aid and support. And that really suggests that we didn't have a plan. The U.S. didn't have a significant plan here.
What do you make of the charges against Maduro? Because they're all basically drug-related, drug trafficking, narco-terrorism. They're not charging him, I guess, as a dictator. I don't even know if that's a charge.
Right. So it's fascinating. So bear with me for a second, historian here, right? So the immediate counterpoint that everybody came up with was, okay, this is just like Manuel Noriega. And the Trump administration has suggested that. So in 1989, the U.S. went into Panama, grabbed the general who was ruling the country. He wasn't calling himself president, and he hadn't stood in elections, but took him back and tried him for drug trafficking, also arms dealing and a few other things. And what you saw in that moment was Latin American countries came out and really rejected that and said the U.S. should not be intervening in the hemisphere and doing this sort of thing, taking a leader, even though he was not liked. Manuel Noriega was very similar to Maduro, was not well liked. Fast forward to now, 2026, January 3rd, U.S. takes out Maduro, brings him back to the U.S. to try him, also for drug trafficking. Latin American responses have been very different. A number of countries have really supported this. Obviously, the Venezuelan opposition, like Machado, has, but you've also seen Chilean support for this action. You've seen Argentinian, Ecuadorian support. You've seen a bunch of other countries reject it, particularly from the farther left, like Brazil. So you see a real divide here, even though people don't like Maduro. And the next step is Americans are thinking, okay, well, how he got here will matter. And what the charges are will matter. But in American courts, it doesn't necessarily matter for criminal charges that he was abducted or that he's making the claims he's already making in court. What matters is if some of those charges will stick. And what we saw with Noriega was that they did. And if the Biden and Trump administrations have lined up a good enough sort of set of evidence in terms of how the Venezuelan state has in fact been taking kickbacks from these narco trafficking organizations, I think they may well have a strong case here. And you might wind up with the very odd to the regular sort of news watcher and reader result that he and his wife could be convicted in U.S. courts, despite the fact that there's all this other evidence that the operation was illegal, or that that he was kidnapped, as even Donald Trump has said. That's fascinating. It may not matter in American courts how he got here. It may not matter what his status was as a leader. And the same sort of thing happened with Noriega in 1989 and 90.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about Venezuela with Christopher McKnight Nichols, Woody Hayes Chair in National Security Studies at Ohio State University. So in one of his remarks after the seizure, President Trump referenced the Monroe Doctrine as justification for the actions taken in Venezuela. So you're going to have to back up and give us a history lesson again, because, you know, what is the Monroe Doctrine and why is Donald Trump talking about it?
I love it. It's helped all of us historians to have a few extra things to say about the past. So 1823, James Monroe issues basically three paragraphs in his seventh statement to Congress. And it was intended to ward off European colonialism. The argument was, as revolutions were happening in Central and South America, pushing back particularly against the Spanish Empire, the U.S. would be a force for good in the hemisphere. The U.S. would not interfere in those revolutions, but also said no further European colonialism could happen. Mm-hmm. So it was an effort to protect the hemisphere without directly intervening. There's a few other key moments here. Around the end of the Civil War, the U.S. tells the French to not keep in and impose an emperor in Mexico, and invokes the Monroe Doctrine to say, France, stay out. Late 19th century, there's a number, in early 20th century, a number of incidents that actually involve Venezuela. And this is what historians are really interested in, because Venezuela is an enormous country. It's about 30% bigger than Texas. It would be the second or third biggest state in the U.S. Got tons of resources in the 19th century, gold. Now we think of the oil, potentially lots of rare earth minerals now is another thing in the 21st century worth noting. So the Monroe Doctrine, around the turn of the 20th century, and I won't elaborate it too much, becomes more about police actions under Teddy Roosevelt and the Roosevelt Corollary in 1904. And it argues that, he begins to argue that the U.S. should intervene in the governments and actions of those in Central and South America and the Caribbean to make sure that they're doing right, paying their debts, that sort of thing. So you see examples of the U.S. sending Marines into Haiti and the Dominican Republic, taking over customs houses so they pay their debts to European powers, in standoffs with the German or British Navy at various moments. And you start to get this much more interventionist role in the hemisphere. What the Monroe Doctrine often then did was serve as a sort of intellectual justification for particular actions. So you could think about the Cuban Missile Crisis and throwing up a quarantine around the island of Cuba so no more Russian nukes could go in. It's been that kind of justification in the 20th century. The thing that stands out about the Monroe Doctrine in our current moment, and I was recently talking to some Latin American specialists about this, is that the U.S. never bombed a South American capital like we just did. The U.S. did take over places, including Veracruz in 1914, when Wilson invaded to keep the peace in Mexico, but never quite did this. So this sort of stands out as something different and distinct. And it remains to be seen, you know, how Latin American leaders and citizens will think about this kind of difference in U.S. interventionism in the hemisphere.
What you were talking about in 1989 with Panama and Noriega, did they invoke the Monroe Doctrine then? Were we talking about that in 1989?
That's a great question. You see a few references to it, but it is not like what we've heard now, right? So the national security strategy of the U.S. now under Trump that was released a few months ago talks explicitly about a Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. That was not something that you saw from George Bush in that moment. This was really a post-Cold War police action in the hemisphere, and that's how the U.S. thought about it.
One of the topics that you study and focus on is United States isolationism. So how does that tie in with all of this?
You know, that's a great question. So on the one hand, right now, this is in keeping with a tradition of isolationism, believe it or not. Very often, American isolationists have believed in unilateral action in the nation's best interest. And if the best interest of the nation was to get rid of a bad leader who was acting poorly nearby, this was the sort of thing that isolationists in the American tradition would have been behind. On the other hand, in that same tradition were those who absolutely abhorred unilateral interventionism. I think we see that wing in the MAGA group and in the right wing of the Republican Party today, the sort of weary of the endless wars folks who see this as yet another intervention and use of a very large standing army for what? Right. And that's the key in isolationist arguments. Is this in the nation's vital interests? And I think that's been a real challenge for the Trump administration to articulate. We've heard a lot about oil, but no specific plans. The U.S. is actually, you know, a net exporter of oil now, doesn't really need oil. So why did this happen? In another era, even the Noriega era, you would have heard human rights. You would have heard other kinds of claims and arguments, justification, democracy, idealism. Isolationists haven't always believed that that was a good reason for the U.S. to go abroad. But that at least is a more transcendent one than oil.
So putting the United States' best interest into this, is this more about drugs or is this more about oil?
You know, it's hard to discern. One challenge with trying to read the tea leaves of the Trump administration is you have lots of different voices saying different things. But I think you look to their actions to see what the outcomes have been and why things are happening. From August through January, we've had the U.S. military, one of the largest buildups of the U.S. Navy in the Caribbean, interdicting ships, right, attacking and destroying ships that the U.S. has said are narco-terrorists trafficking drugs. And so I think one way to actually wrap in one more piece of this is to add immigration policy. So Venezuela, since the Chavez administration, but he died in 2013 and Maduro took over, has been just flooding the hemisphere with migrants because of the poverty and insecurity in Venezuela. Roughly 8 million Venezuelans have left in the last decade, and there's more than a million in the U.S. I think part of the Trump administration's thinking is really about border control and immigration, and that's wrapped up in drug policy, as well as, to some extent, international trade. But I think it's more drugs and immigration policy, as you're seeing here. And I also think we're seeing signals from former Senator Marco Rubio, now Secretary of State, that this is partly about Colombia. So Colombia's very close ties to Venezuela meant that Venezuela was helping prop up the Colombian economy through oil, among other things. And there are actually Cuban security agents guarding Maduro, many of whom are reportedly were killed. So the Cuban relations with Venezuela are now disrupted somewhat by this. And Marco Rubio has for a long time wanted to change the regime in Cuba.
So wait, you said Colombia and Cuba. So are we talking about both?
Both. Okay. Yeah, sorry. Okay. Both are involved. So Cuba has been reliant on oil exports from Venezuela. Mm-hmm. But Colombia has had close ties with Venezuela, and Colombia is a much, much more of a problematic drug trafficker to the U.S. Mm. Venezuelan cocaine often goes to Europe, actually.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. Staying with us after the break is Christopher McKnight Nichols, National Security Studies, the Woody Hayes Chair in National Security Studies at Ohio State University. Coming up, we're going to talk more about Venezuelan oil, and we're also going to discuss the lack of involvement of the United States Congress in this entire thing. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Often seen as a global hall monitor, many of the international laws we have in place are because the United States and its many global policing organizations. However, with the recent capture of a foreign country's leader, have those international laws been violated? And how does this affect America's image on the global stage? What are other countries thinking, like Russia and China? And how are they going to respond to our actions? Still with us is Christopher McKnight Nichols, Woody Hayes Chair in National Security Studies at Ohio State University. Thanks again for joining us, Chris.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
So let's talk about that global stage thing, the perception of the U.S. Mm. Are we the global hall monitor? And does what happened here change that role?
I think this is part of a gradual fracturing of that role. Yes, you saw world leaders come out, the non-Latin American leaders, pretty unequivocally against this action. Mm-hmm. In international law, coming in to seize a head of state is just absolutely verboten. It is not allowed. That is a extrajudicial, unsanctioned action. The UN could do an action like that, could authorize the use of force and build a coalition, but that is not something that countries are supposed to do, even if there are domestic charges against those leaders. So you could look around the world, there are charges by international criminal courts and domestic courts against probably several dozen sitting leaders. And no one condones going in and grabbing those individuals. So that's an enormous change for the U.S. And it's though the U.S. has interfered in the hemisphere a lot over the years, they've mostly been covert at the highest level of regime change, not this kind of overt, dramatic action.
Well, let's talk for a moment about Congress and the fact that Congress did not vote about this. I can remember the vote about whether or not to take action in Iraq. That vote has been brought up in election after election for years and years to come in the U.S. So why was Congress not involved here?
You're so right. So the Trump administration has said several things. One, that they couldn't trust Congress, so they wouldn't even brief the so-called Gang of Eight, the head of a bipartisan group who are the heads of some of the most major committees like foreign relations and intelligence, armed forces. So they wouldn't even brief them because they feared leaks from members, sitting members of Congress, arguably including in their own party. They
like Congress was going to call Maduro and say, you better watch out.
Yeah, I mean, that's the implication, right? Mm. These august senators and congressmen would get on the hotline and call Maduro. But also just I think that they thought it would be politicized, for better or for worse, that somehow this would get they'd immediately be able to spin it, the opposition party or something like that. That is Democrats. The other piece, though, that I think is important for your average American citizen to think about, especially thinking back to 2001 and 2002, the authorization for the use of armed forces against Iraq was incredibly broad. And that has helped justify actions against ISIS, Al-Qaeda, all the way down the line for years, different branch groups in the Philippines, in Indonesia. That has been a caution to many Americans and many members of Congress to have much more limited authorizations for the use of military force. And you could imagine a different administration going to Congress and saying, hey, we need to do this for these particular reasons, authorize a very limited strike. What the Trump administration has said is this does not constitute war. They've had two or three different arguments here, and they're mutually contradictory, to be honest with you. So one is that this is a police action related to narco-terrorism, and they're bringing Maduro to New York to stand trial in criminal court. The other is that this is a non-international war or conflict that does not require a declaration of war, but does require the use of military force using the commander-in-chief's Article 2 power as head of the army. That's what they're justifying in terms of the strikes on boats and this military operation.
A non-international, but it isn't. I don't understand that. It's a non-international act of war, but it is another country.
Amy, I'm with you, but the point is it's not two nation states fighting, but rather drug traffickers within Venezuela who've corrupted members of the administration, but not the country, and the United States of America. So one is a nation and one is a transnational network of bad actors. That's what they're basically arguing in that unwieldy phrase.
Okay. But I feel like not even briefing Congress. I read that some members of Congress found out about the capture of Maduro on their phones on January 3rd, just like the rest of us. I mean, that's unusual, right? I mean, how are these people going to feel about the Trump administration when they weren't even given a heads up before it leaked to the media?
It's hard for members of Congress to trust the administration after this. You know, I think there are examples historically of covert strikes happening without much warning to Congress, but zero is awfully unprecedented, and it certainly will leave a bad taste in their mouths when the Trump administration suggests that members of Congress trust them, right? The other piece of this is, of course, it is in the oversight powers of Congress. We're seeing in this moment this diminution of Congress, but Congress is supposed to look at this stuff, right? They're supposed to be our representatives. And I mean this in the most nonpartisan way, and judge whether or not these are actions in the best interest of the country, right? And so the fact that they weren't briefed, there is no authorization for the use of force, and force continues to be used. I mean, this enormous buildup of the navies in the Caribbean, and if you want to think about it in security studies terms, right, that it comes at a direct cost of the U.S. projecting power elsewhere. There are fewer American naval forces in the Middle East if there's a problem, in Asia to combat China. Whatever you think is an important priority globally, right now the Trump administration has prioritized and not really told Congress why particular actions in Venezuela.
See, I watch The West Wing. I watch The Diplomat. I get it. The more people who know, the more chance that it'll leak. I do understand that. But I guess it now that it's happened, is Congress weighing in? Like, are they being looped in now?
We're seeing very little of that. We haven't had a large scale briefings that I've heard about. There have been some briefings since this happened, but we're already 10 days out, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I think just to spin it back, if you think about West Wing or some of the ways in which this is dramatized, the Trump administration could easily have brought in a limited number of members of Congress to brief them as representatives of the wider group. And they chose not to. And that's a choice. That's a policy choice. And it'll have repercussions in terms of trust and support later.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about Venezuela with Christopher McKnight Nichols, the Woody Hayes Chair in National Security Studies at Ohio State University. Do you think other countries are going to take us seriously because of actions like this? I'm thinking in the eyes of, you know, Russia or China. Like, what are they thinking right now?
Yeah. So there's two or three ways to parse that. One is the Trump administration's actions here are part of this national security strategy, Monroe Doctrine, Trump corollary move to expand the U.S.'s explicit overt use of force in the hemisphere. This is our hemisphere. It's the U.S.'s hemisphere. Everybody else stay out. And the U.S. will police it. The argument in international terms then is that China should have its own sphere of influence. And the question is, what are the limits in terms of Taiwan or the South China Sea? And what does that mean for Russia in terms of Ukraine? You could argue that the Vladimir Putin could be more bold in attacks on individuals like Zelensky heading Ukraine, saying, hey, the U.S. did this. We've accused Zelensky of all kinds of crimes and corruption. So that's one piece of that. The other, in the eyes of the international community, what are the ramifications? I think unsanctioned use of force against the leader of a head of state is a fairly illegitimate action. In the international community, another comparison historically would be when Saddam Hussein took over Kuwait, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, kind of rogue actors who overnight take over other countries or do these enormous operations against other countries outside of the confines of international law become more pariah-like. The U.S. isn't going to be alienated by the world community, but it's hard to create coalitions and have goodwill when the U.S. is doing this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then I think there's the hemispheric dimension. Lots of leaders in Central and South America right now are probably worried. Where mm-hmm. will Trump, you know, cast his gaze next? And will it be sufficient to possibly overturn a government or meddle in some other way, shape, or form? Mm-hmm.
Maduro was a close ally of Putin. So with the seizure of Maduro and then the fall of Syria's former president as well, some of Russia's closest allies are no longer in power. So what does that mean to Russia? You know, does it change Russia's influence on a global stage if Russia has fewer allies?
It certainly will change to some extent their global stage kind of prestige. But one way to think about Russia's actions in Venezuela have been as a kind of thorn in the side of the U.S. generally. They weren't very close allies, although Chavez bought some really significant anti-aircraft weapons, for instance, that reportedly weren't fully hooked up or weren't well serviced when the U.S. attacked on January 3rd. And one reason for that is that Russia has been so focused on Ukraine that many of their trainers and operators have had to be back involved in that conflict. You see, similarly with Syria, Russia didn't want to pay the cost to try to keep propping up Bashar al-Assad. So I think what that signals in the global community is Russia is focused on its borders. And we've seen statements from Russian leadership saying that Belarus and some of its closer allies right on its borders are its real allies. And countries like Venezuela are, you know, friends and acquaintances, but they're not closely linked. And I think that also suggests this sphere of influence thinking that we're increasingly seeing in the world community, and that should probably concern us, that sort of nation states that are willing to take more forceful action are doing that closer to their own borders. And this is, you know, really the big three right now of Russia, China, and the U.S.
Well, before we run out of time, I wanted to swing back to oil for a minute because, you know, many see the capture of Maduro as a way to bolster American companies. Representative Veronica Escobar, a Democrat of Texas, is quoted as saying it is all about oil in reference to Venezuela. Do you think that that's accurate? Because you talked earlier about how it's more about immigration and drugs, but I feel the oil piece is still there.
Oh, the oil is absolutely there. I think it's the oil piece is what has been a kind of constant reference for Donald Trump for years, going back to his first administration and his earlier clashes with Maduro. And he tends to claim, rightly and somewhat mistakenly, about the nationalization of oil infrastructure that happened first in 1976 in Venezuela, and then has happened at several stages since then of U.S. companies' infrastructure. And sort of renegotiations of that. I think that's a piece of this. It'll take a while to get the oil flowing. It will take a while to build this infrastructure. None of this will happen very fast. You know, the embargoes right now, I think, are going to hurt countries like Cuba if the U.S. stops oil going to them much more than we'll see any economic changes here. I think the big picture takeaway, if you're thinking about ideology, unilateralism, isolationism, like what is this change signal, is that the U.S. is now, the highest levels of the U.S. leadership are saying that the U.S. is intervening in another country more for material resources than for idealism, democracy, human rights. And that's a real change. Even when you could discern as kind of economic driver under the surface, very often American leaders did a lot more lip service, at least, to human rights questions. Here we're seeing Donald Trump explicitly say oil, 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 and members of Congress, even Democrats, saying that too, although I think they're often saying it in a pejorative way. The U.S. does not want to be imperialist and go in and take oil. And taking oil is a much harder bargain. Mm-hmm. Really, this is about having multinational, multilateral kind of operations through big companies do oil extraction.
We only have about 30 seconds left, but when you say take oil, it'll take some time. Are you talking years, like Donald Trump won't be president anymore, or are you talking just like months?
More like years to build the infrastructure, definitely. Mm-hmm. I mean, the infrastructure reportedly is needs a lot of work. There aren't the security guarantees. It'll take time to put together the funding packages, probably. Mm-hmm. And as far as we know, many oil executives, even ones who've signaled that they're interested in being involved in the Venezuelan oil industry, are wary of investing a lot of capital. So I think you're looking at years, you know, through the end of the Trump administration. Short term, you'll see some flow of oil probably to the U.S. There doesn't appear to be a plan, say, through the U.S. Treasury, Department of Interior, about how to distribute it or where the funds would go. Would they go back to Venezuela? So we're still groping towards a plan in terms of the shorter term oil exchanges and international economics questions.
I want to thank you so much for your time. We've been talking with Christopher McKnight Nichols, the Woody Hayes Chair in National Security Studies at Ohio State University. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much. Great to be on.
And this has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for listening.